Hello and welcome to the You Should Run podcast. I'm your host, Bridgeport Councilmember Tony Heil. And normally we start with a little cold open to kind of joke into this, but this is the biggest podcast we've had so far. And want to just jump right into the conversation with my special guest, Congressman, former state legislator, father, Wawa fan, Phillies fan, Eagles fan, Sixers fan, whatever other Philadelphia sports fan, Congressman Brenda Boyle. Thank you for being a guest on the podcast today.
Oh, great to be with you. And as you know, big admirer of yours, Tony. And I think that the whole idea for this podcast is just wonderful and very much needed. So I was excited when you initiated the offer on Twitter, I think. Was excited to say yes and happy to be with you.
Well, the fact that you remember that I initiated this on Twitter is one of the things we might talk about, not Twitter specifically, but I admire your ability to remember things because you are much better at that than I am. And you remember people's names and faces and locations and all this stuff that I'm sure has aided your career. But today we're going to be talking the same things we talk about in every podcast, why you ran for office, the challenges of that and running and being in office, and you know, things that are most important to you, and why you hopefully encourage other people to run for office too. So first, Brendan, Congressman Boyle.
Now you can call me Brendan.
I think of you often because I watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I'm through season four right now, so there's one of the main characters is named Boyle.
Oh, okay. Oh, gotcha.
All right. You should watch it a lot. First, why did you get involved in politics? Were you always political with your family, or is it something that came up through your education?
Yeah, so I get this question a lot, and sometimes people are a little surprised that I didn't grow up at all in a political family. My dad was immigrant, came to America when he was 19, blue-collar worker his entire life as a warehouseman and later a janitor. And my mom was a full-time stay-at-home mom in addition to being a part-time school crossing guard in the neighborhood in Philadelphia in which we grew up, which isn't very far from where we're sitting right now. And they were, you know, staunch Democrats, never missed an election, believed it was an important part as American citizens, but not at all political and certainly not ever running for office. And people are a little surprised by that because both me and my brother, who is my only sibling, there are only two of us, but we were both in elective office, both ran for office, and both did so at fairly young ages. Growing up, I was always very interested in politics from as early as I can remember. Was also very interested in sports and still am. So I always had a feeling that this is what I wanted to do and be involved in. Although when I was in college, while I was a political science major, I really doubted if any sort of career in politics was for me. And you know, when I graduated, I went in a different direction. I had, as my late mom called it, a nice normal job, working in a suburb of Washington, D.C. I moved there, did a lot of Defense Department work. So it was government related, but nothing political at all. You know, I really didn't feel fulfilled. I very much felt drawn to politics. I knew that I wanted to move back home as well. And then it was actually September 11th that helped kind of cinch things for me. And actually that afternoon, I was in Old Town Alexandria. We had a small satellite office, you know, a couple miles south of the Pentagon. And it was really that day that cinched things for me. And I decided that I would go back to graduate school specifically for public policy. Ultimately I would move back home to Philadelphia. And I was in my early 20s at the time, but working in a defense environment, you knew people who had friends in the Pentagon, and it was a crystallizing moment that while I was young, life is maybe, you know, life is not forever, and it's maybe shorter than we realize, and to really go after what you want to do.
Yeah, I think we're very close in age, and I think that for our generation, 9/11 may not have made us run for office then, because I didn't for many years and you didn't for a few years, but it was one of those things where you couldn't not be political at that point, whether you were conservative, right, liberal, yeah. Like you have to pay attention to the world.
And actually, to demonstrate this point, so I ended up then only applying to graduate schools of public policy that fall, the same fall, September 11th, was accepted, and ended up on campus. I went to the Harvard Kennedy School, and my first day was September 11th, 2002, wow, the one-year anniversary of September 11th. And I'll never forget the then dean of the Kennedy School, Joe Nye, saying that, calling it the September 11th effect, that the Kennedy School, as well as other schools of public service, had experienced a greater than 100% increase in applications. So we are part of a generation that I think was motivated and called to public service right after September 11th.
Well, with that kind of somber news on to, we were also very young then. We were both, I was 21, you were just a little bit older than that.
Right.
And, you know, you didn't wait your turn.
No.
In politics. Right. Let's put it that way. So you were young when you first ran for the state house. And was that something in you like, no, this, I don't want to wait around. Like, I have an urgency now to do something.
So that's, I ran for state rep against a longtime Republican incumbent immediately after the Kennedy School. And, you know, Philadelphia, even though it's the fifth largest city and is in many ways cosmopolitan, it's also in many ways old-fashioned, and especially its political culture. So I certainly met, even though I'm a Democrat, within the Democratic Party, a certain resistance that I hadn't paid my dues, I wasn't waiting my turn, very much faced that when I was first running, and just had to overcome it through sheer hard work. You can overcome it. But it also does take a lot. But I you know, if I had waited my turn or, you know, forced myself to do certain things or hold certain views that aren't true to who I am, then I don't think I would be sitting in Congress where I am today, or my brother would be in his state house, because he had a similar path, taking on the Republican, longtime Republican incumbent, had been there 30 years, was Speaker of the House. Had a number of Democratic ward leaders that were actually supporting the Republican.
I remember that.
He was running against. So before we could even face, you know, the longtime Republicans who were in those seats, we had to take on some within the Democratic Party in Philadelphia.
Now, when you ran then for an open seat in 2014, and you knew then that you would be running in a time when Republicans were probably going to keep the majority in Congress.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of challenges for you. You're going to run against a well-known person in the primary, crowded primary. You didn't know if you would win, but was it the same kind of attitude like, well, I can't wait my turn, I can't wait for, because who knows what'll happen there, that kind of motivated you, like, if I'm gonna do it, I gotta do it?
Yes, I so as Tony remembers, with my predecessor deciding that, my predecessor is a congresswoman who was very able and represented the seat for 10 years, she decided to run for governor, creating an open seat. And the establishment favorite was Marjorie Margolis Mesvinsky, mm-hmm, who had been a congresswoman in the 90s and was famously Chelsea Clinton's mother-in-law. I decided to run, as did a number of others. Initially, it was a six-way race and then very quickly cemented to a four-way race. But even among the four of us, no doubt that the person who was the faraway favorite was Margolis. And when we did our first poll, it showed that I was 32 points behind, which I thought was pretty bad, until after the election, we somehow became friends with Margolis' pollster, and he said, oh, we didn't have it as close as 32 points. Their poll showed it was an even greater number. And this is a true story. In June of 2013, about 10 months before the election, after our first poll came back, the D.C. consultant that we had hired tried to convince me that this was unwinnable, thought that it was just a suicidal run, and ultimately fired me as a client because he thought, you know, just not listening. There's no way this can be won. And left on good terms, but he thought that this was impossible and dropped me as a client. But ultimately, we persevered and
persisted
as someone else has said, and went on to win by 14 points. And we focused a lot on really the sort of economic message that now, since then, has caught on nationally, just speaking about the kind of time that we're in of deep stagnation with the middle class and working class of our country.
Yeah, that reminds me of something, just to skip ahead a little bit, but in reading up on the issues you've supported since you got into politics, you were an early supporter of LGBT rights as something that you probably didn't need to, I don't know, but from your district, but you...
I represented a state rep district that was moderate to somewhat conservative culturally in Northeast Philadelphia, right. And so my LGBT position was not necessarily helpful politically.
So in addition to not being conservative in terms of politics, you were not conservative in terms of holding back. It seems like you're a few years ahead of where everyone else is. You're, when it comes to the environment, you're talking about climate change in ways that other people should be and aren't yet. Where you're talking about these economic issues, like you said, in 2014. Are you trying to think when you're doing these things and you're running for office, we need to be there? And I'm making gestures on a podcast and no one can see that, but you're thinking like, you know, I'm not doing this to just kind of keep the status quo. That's not enough.
Well, thank you. I'm attempting to get it right and fighting for what I believe in. And a lot of these things come out of my own experience. Although with LGBT, as it was called then, now LGBTQ, I was about a decade ago. I was relatively new in the state house, and I was one of only, as I recall that first meeting, we did not need a large room for that first meeting because it was maybe six or seven state representatives, along with a group called Equality PA that formed the Equality Caucus. None of us in the room were actually LGBT ourselves, but we thought it was important to that allies of this civil rights issue of our time come together and form a caucus, because in Harrisburg, and as we've seen since then, there are many anti-LGBT initiatives that were being pushed. And to me, even though I'm not gay myself, I just think that it is so obvious that this is the civil rights issue of our time, that you have a group of people who have an orientation, as we all do. I think that sexual orientation is innate. I think the gender identity is innate. So to me, it's a no-brainer. Now, politically, how I handled that strategically, knowing that, you know, I had just recently taken over for a Republican. It had always been a Republican-held seat. I believed that I could bring along people for whom this might not be their most important issue. Maybe they were mildly against LGBT rights, but you know, it wasn't their most important issue. I thought that if I spoke primarily about other concerns and where we had common agreement, that I could also pull folks along when it comes to this issue. And I feel good about the fact that overall, I think that that's actually what's happened nationwide. When you look at the tremendous progress that's happened in this area over the last 10 years. The other thing that I pushed very early on in those state house campaigns was higher education affordability. Mm-hmm. First bill that I introduced in the state legislature was a more limited form of free college, attempting to bring to Pennsylvania something called the Hope Scholarship, which was started in Georgia and then later in the state of Florida and a few other states. And it was my way of trying to tackle the problem of Pennsylvania's incredibly expensive colleges and universities. And I'm very happy that while it wasn't much discussed back in the middle part and latter part of the last decade, I'm so glad that now it is finally being discussed.
Yeah, and it's not something that you discuss once and then like, oh, remember when I talked about it back then? You've been pretty consistent on all these things. Now, you ran and you're in the state house and Congress. What are one or two challenges either for running or being in those offices that stick out to you? Because you could name 100 or 10, and I don't need the time for that. But
so running very quickly, the biggest challenge is, for me, raising money.
Right. Especially when you have really tough elections.
When you have tough elections, and also, you know, when you're someone who's of a more working class or middle class background, and you're dealing with a number of self-funders, that's an enormous challenge in our system. And I think that it's a real threat to representative democracy that we are increasingly making it difficult for people of more modest means to run for office. That's not the way the system was created, was envisioned when it was created. So that would, there are many others, but certainly that would be one of the main challenges. In terms of in office, I've served in legislative bodies now for a decade, and when you're in the minority, it is obviously more difficult to affect change. And typically success on a given day might be stopping something bad from happening versus making something good happen.
Considering some of the bad things that have been happening, that's a good thing when you can do that.
Yeah, especially in the last couple years, in 2017 and 2018. We're in the House, we actually had a lot of success in blocking a great deal of bad things from happening. But I will say that it taught me the importance of being able to reach across the aisle mm-hmm. and find allies on specific issues. I was able to get a Ukraine cybersecurity bill passed last session because I found a Republican partner on it, had him as my lead co-sponsor, and we were able to push it together. So it was a great education in how the system works when you're in the minority, if you want to be effective.
Well, that's good. And like you said, you can be effective no matter where you are in politics and find your way to do it. And then one of the lessons I'm getting from listening to you is also don't be timid or patient. You know, strike when you can. But you talked about a lot of these things. Are there any, what's your number one issue? If you could do anything, or one or two issues that you care most about right now that people should pay attention to, you think?
It's so hard to narrow down because I am a generalist and care a lot of, about a great number of issues. But I'll pick out two that are timely and I think will continue to be so. One is the student debt crisis that we have right now. So I made it my number one issue when I was running for the State House way back when, and in many ways it still is. Only the problem has gotten significantly worse over the last 10, 15 years. Right now, and when I say right now, actually within the last several weeks, the United States hit a milestone. We now have over $1.5 trillion worth of student debt. And I make a two-prong argument why that is horrible. Number one, you have an entire generation going on two generations that have this massive amount of debt, which is affecting when they can start a family or if they can start a family, affecting career decisions, affecting quality of life.
If people can't buy a home in my community because they have too much debt, so they're just renting.
Exactly.
Which is fine, but I would much rather someone my age or younger buy a home and invest in that home in my neighborhood.
Which, by the way, is why this is such a big issue now for the National Association of Realtors.
Yes.
You don't exactly think as necessarily a very left-leaning group. Student loan debt is now their second biggest issue that they lobby on, only after keeping the deductibility of mortgage interest. That was not the case 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And you were ahead of them, again.
Well, so that's I mentioned the two-prong argument. That's the first prong, that you have all of these individuals, millions of Americans who are being deeply affected by it. But there's a second-prong argument, and that is, suppose you don't have student debt. Suppose you're not the parent or grandparent of someone who has a massive amount of student debt. Suppose you're not someone who is deciding not to go to college because of the affordability issue. This student debt crisis even affects you, and here's why. We right now are at $1.5 trillion worth of debt in a relatively low interest rate environment in an economy that is 9 years into an economic expansion. What do we think is going to happen to that debt crisis once, if and when, the next recession occurs?
And it's more when than if.
Oh, correct. Yeah. I mean, if we don't have a recession, it would be the first time in human history that we haven't had a cycle of expansion and then inevitably recession. We already see rather high default rates right now. So when the next recession occurs, this massive amount of debt will be not just an issue for the individuals who have that debt, it's going to be an issue for all of us.
Yeah.
Much the same way the real estate bubble affected all of us in the economy about a decade ago. So I'm attempting to tackle this now, again, to get ahead of things, working on a number of different legislative ideas to address this. because we either need to address it now when it's a serious problem, or we're going to be forced to address it later when it's an even greater problem and even harder to solve.
Oh, great. Well, I want to make sure we get to one of the most important parts of this podcast, which is why...
My Phillies prediction? No.
Well, like, I would say 162-0, but obviously it will be a little bit less than that. No, but why... This is called You Should Run.
Yeah.
Why should people run for office, whatever office it is? Why should people get involved in the process?
Yeah. Well, first, I think that every single person should get involved in the process. I believe in active citizenship. Right. I taught a class at Drexel University for a couple of years, actually on running a campaign and all that goes into it. And as I said then, this is important for all the students, whether you go on to run for office or run a campaign or work in a campaign. It's important because just simply as a citizen in our democracy, you want to know what this looks like on the other side of the curtain, that it actually it'll help all of us make informed decisions. But specifically on why you should run for office, the decisions are made by the people who bother to show up. And if you don't get involved in a representative democracy, then essentially by default, you're allowing others to make those decisions for you. I worry right now that we have a representative democracy that is not actually very representative of our country. I serve in a legislative body in which the majority of members of Congress are part of the wealthiest 1%. Mm-hmm. Now, I serve with many fine people. Many of them are millionaires and even a few worth hundreds of millions and happen to be nice people. But the reality is they've had a life experience very different than mine and very different than 99% of the American people. It's really hard to say that we have a fully representative democracy when the people who make laws for us are drawn out of such a narrow pool of very different life experiences. So I think that we need more diversity in elective office, and I mean diversity in the true sense of the term. Yes, that means racial and ethnic diversity, but it also means diversity of age. Yes. I'm often one of the youngest people in the room. For my first 4 years in Congress, I was more than 20 years younger than the average age in Congress, so it's great that we have many older people represented, but we also need more people my age and younger.
And you're also one of the younger people represented in the state legislature, too.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So I was always, although with this most recent 2018 election, the average age in Congress has come down considerably. It's still higher than actually my age, but I am glad to see, you know, progress being made on that front. But we need diversity in the true sense of the term. That also includes socioeconomic diversity as well. So I do want to see more people run for office at all sorts of levels. It doesn't just have to be at the federal level. There are all sorts of very important elective offices, and we need good, well-intended people to serve.
Okay, well, I appreciate what you're doing. You know, you've gotten young people involved. We both are supportive of the YEO Network, Young Elected Officials. We're both grandfathered in, which seems weird because either us are that old. Are there any other organizations people should think about?
Well, you know, there are a number of organizations that are geared toward younger people in elective office. Actually, I would hate to pick out one or two because I've noticed in the last 2 years, you have seen a dramatic increase in the number of grassroots organizations that are geared toward getting people more involved in politics, especially younger people. So the nice thing is today, from what I've been able to see, there are actually more groups dedicated toward this than at any point in the decade or so that I've been in politics.
Well, great. So there's no reason to be patient.
No, I patience has its place. I'm often impatient about how slow it can be sometimes to effect change. But the idea that you just have to sit there and quote-unquote wait your turn, I've never been a fan of that or a believer in it, and I would encourage other people to seize the moment.
Well, Brandon, Congressman Boyle, I appreciate that you were not patient, that you were so impatient that you jumped on the chance to be on this podcast, and that you were impatient enough to challenge the status quo and run for office. So thank you very much for joining the podcast, and I appreciate your time.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.